You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the globe to bring you the latest developments in medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. We love the herb. It's time for the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. Now, here's your host, Russ Belville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Thursday, May 18th, 2017, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. Welcome to the program. We've got plenty to talk about today on the Marijuana Agenda. Coming up in our Police for Reform segment, we've got Michael Sindrich joining us from San Diego, California, where he was a former prosecutor and now heads up the San Diego County Normal Chapter, is vice president of the Gridiron Cannabis Foundation, and a great speaker for Law Enforcement Action Partnership. We're going to talk about the implementation of Prop 64 legalization in the state of California. Also on our show today, our new segment, What About the Children? We feature Moms for Marijuana founder Sarah Frank, who's going to discuss the misuse of child protective services against parents who use cannabis. Also coming up on the show in Drug War Data Mining, got a new report from MJ Biz Daily telling us that legal marijuana could top $17 billion in sales by the year 2021. And in the Radical Rant, I'll tell you the tale of a West Virginia police officer who was fired for not killing a mentally distressed man. We start everything off with the cannabis headline news. And the big headline today is that the Ninth Circuit has declined a case that has severe implications for our federal marijuana prisoners. That's all coming up today on the Marijuana Agenda.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Looking for the 420 friendliest way to visit beautiful legal potland Oregon?
I'm Lori Duckworth, inviting you to come stay with us at Delta 9 House and Studios.
You get your own private room with queen bed and access to our high-speed Wi-Fi, premium entertainment system, and more.
We'll even cook you breakfast. Look us up on Facebook at Delta 9 House.
That's facebook.com/Delta9House.
Delta 9 House is booked through Airbnb.com. City of Portland permit number 17-159855.
Hey, this is Willie Nelson, or Norman, and I smoke pot and I like it a lot. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer than alcohol. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting those who smoke marijuana responsibly. To learn what you can do to help, contact Normal at NORML.org or call toll-free 888-67-NORMAL.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
It's like I picked the wrong week to quit smoking.
Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
I'm Russ Belville with the Marijuana Agenda. Join me every 4 weeks for Veterans of Compassion with the Veterans Cannabis Group. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
This is your cannabis headline news. Brought to you by MarijuanaMoment.net. The complete source for all your marijuana news in one morning newsletter from Marijuana Majority founder Tom Angel. Subscribe today for free at MarijuanaMoment.net.
This is your cannabis headline news for Thursday, May 18th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville. A federal appeals court has sidestepped making a ruling on whether U.S. prison officials can hold people who were convicted of marijuana offenses that were legal under state medical marijuana laws. In a decision Wednesday, the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals focused instead on a narrower issue. The court was considering a legal challenge by prisoner Matthew Davies, who was convicted of federal marijuana charges.
Davey said he ran medical marijuana dispensaries that complied with California law. He argued that the Bureau of Prisons could not hold him because of a federal regulation that restricted interference by U.S. officials in the implementation of state medical marijuana laws. The Ninth Circuit avoided the issue, ruling instead that Davey's plea agreement did not allow his legal challenge. Davey's attorney, Cody Harris, said he is analyzing the ruling. A small bipartisan group of lawmakers is renewing a push at the federal level to legalize marijuana, calling it a criminal justice issue. The Ending Federal Marijuana Prohibition Act, sponsored by Representative Thomas Garrett, a Republican of Virginia, would lift the nation's pot restrictions and allow states to decide how to regulate medical and recreational marijuana. Currently, states like Colorado that legalize marijuana do so in violation of federal law. This has created a confusing patchwork of marijuana laws across the country. The bill, which has 11 co-sponsors, was introduced in February and has gathered little momentum on Capitol Hill. Garrett hopes to build consensus despite indications that President Trump's administration is moving towards stronger enforcement of federal marijuana laws. Kevin Sabet, president of Smart Approaches to Marijuana, which advocates against ending cannabis prohibition, called these lawmakers' approach to criminal justice reform a, quote, Cheech and Chong ideology, end quote. Regulators have issued the first license to grow medical cannabis in Maryland, allowing a sprawling 2-acre warehouse in Anne Arundel County to immediately start cultivating the plant. The Maryland Medical Cannabis Commission voted unanimously Wednesday to grant final approval to a company called Forward Grow, more than 4 years after the state first legalized the medicinal use of marijuana. Forward Grow officials said they expect their product to be available to patients early this fall. Forward Grow was first of 15 companies granted preliminary licenses in August 2016 to earn final approval to grow the cannabis. Since then, the industry has been subject to political controversy and 2 lawsuits over how the potentially lucrative licenses were awarded. Activists in Missouri have received a ballot title for a marijuana legalization petition that, among other provisions, would legalize driving under the influence of cannabis. The initiative, submitted by Doug Burleson of Springfield, would amend the Missouri Constitution. Jay Ashcroft, Missouri's Secretary of State, has released a ballot title that describes the initiative that says passage of the initiative would, quote, legally allow people to drive under the influence of cannabis, remove state prohibitions on the possession, cultivation, and sale of marijuana for personal or medical use, regardless of age, release all individuals from incarceration, parole, and probation if convicted only of nonviolent marijuana-related crimes, remove state prohibitions on the commercial cultivation, manufacture, distribution, and sale of marijuana, destroy all state civil and criminal records of nonviolent marijuana-related crimes, prohibit Missouri assisting enforcement of federal marijuana offenses, and prohibit the taxation of physician-recommended medical marijuana. A South Florida lawmaker compared the legalization of medical marijuana dispensaries in Florida to the legalization of pedophilia. Miami Deputy City Attorney Barnaby Min was pressed by an attorney about the city's lack of concern about regulation of dispensaries in the city. Min offered what he prefaced as a very poor example to illustrate the legal issue with allowing pot shops. Quote, if the city of Miami, for some infinite God-forbidden reason, thought having sex with a child was a great way to recover from some issue, and so we wrote that into our city code, just because the city says that's legal doesn't mean it's legal, end quote, he said. Dr. Carl Hart, one of the world's leading neuroscientists and chair of the psychology department at Columbia University, was forced to cut a trip to the Philippines short earlier this month because of a death threat that was sparked in part by propaganda disguised as media. Hart was in the Philippines participating in a policy forum on the drug war at the University of the Philippines. This has been your Cannabis Headline News for Thursday, May 18, 2017. I'm Russ Belville.
You're listening to The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
At Herbie's Cannabis Seeds, we pride ourselves on bringing you the best quality seeds from the world's most respected cannabis seed producers, all at the lowest online prices. You can find Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. All cannabis seeds are sold as souvenirs and as a means of preserving cannabis genetics. Herbie's Seeds in no way intends to condone, promote, or incite the use of illegal or controlled substances. We strongly urge all prospective customers to check their national laws prior to placing an order. Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. Proud sponsors of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Georgia.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson. Alcohol prohibition didn't work in the 1920s, and marijuana prohibition isn't working today. It's time we stopped arresting responsible marijuana smokers. It's the fair thing to do.
For more information, contact NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Call toll-free 888-67-NORML or visit their website at norml.org.
The Marijuana Agenda. Like the liberal agenda, but with profits. Ka-ching.
I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. Join me every 2 weeks for the voice of the industry from the National Cannabis Industry Association. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
This is Police for Reform. Brought to you by Law Enforcement Action Partnership at LEAP.cc. LEAP is a group of law enforcement professionals advocating for criminal justice reforms in the areas of drug prohibition, mass incarceration, asset forfeiture, community policing, and more. LEAP provides qualified speakers across the world to speak with authority on criminal justice issues. We visit with one such speaker now in Police for Reform.
Welcome to Police for Reform. I'm Russ Belville. Joining us today, we have another fantastic speaker from Law Enforcement Action Partnership joining us. It's Michael Sindrich. He's a former prosecutor for the County of San Diego, California. He's also the executive director of the San Diego County chapter of NORML, a lifetime member of the National NORML Legal Committee, and the co-founder and vice president of the Gridiron Cannabis Foundation. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
We've seen a whole lot of change happening in marijuana reform recently, and of course, California passing Prop 64 is foremost for Californians listening out there. As someone who's working in the reform movement, give us some of your thoughts on what is happening now, politically speaking, when it comes to the implementation of Proposition 64. Are there any particular problems you're worried about or good things happening you didn't expect?
Well, I think the main problem that we're wrestling with right now is how to align Prop 64 and the Medical Cannabis Regulation and Safety Act. The Medical Cannabis Regulation and Safety Act is the law that the state passed last year and was implemented at the beginning of last year, and they are ultimately going to start licensing state medical businesses. However, the Medical Cannabis Regulation and Safety Act is somewhat different than Prop 64, and everyone's wondering how these two new laws are going to work side by side.
Is there concerns about the product supply as far as putting limitations on the recreational side that you wouldn't have on the medical side, things like potency limits or access to edibles, any of those things coming up?
Well, I think it's actually the exact opposite. Prop 64 was a citizen-approved initiative, whereas the Medical Cannabis Regulation and Safety Act was a state legislative law that was passed. So what we're really seeing is that the state is enacting several different restrictions that they may not be able to enact pursuant to Prop 64.
Interesting. Now, another consideration in the wake of passing legalization has to do with the people who had been prosecuted, who are serving time, who have criminal records prior to legalization. Prop 64 had some groundbreaking language as far as retroactive resentencing. How is that proceeding in California?
Yeah, that was some great language. And, you know, in my opinion, the most important part of cannabis reform is eliminating criminal consequences. And Prop 64 has done a great job. It was retroactive. We've been seeing people, you know, as soon as it was passed, people were getting out of prison. They were getting out of jail. They were having their sentences reduced. In some cases, they were having their convictions completely wiped out. So from a criminal justice standpoint, Prop 64 has done a lot of positive as it's been a very positive move for the cannabis industry.
From the perspective of law enforcement, when it comes to Prop 64, and you know, for that matter, nationwide, as legalization is discussed, one of the concerns we hear from law enforcement is the fear of stoned drivers, that there's going to be some sort of stoned mayhem on the freeways now that we've legalized marijuana. I understand Prop 64 had some language in it as far as studying that issue. How is that proceeding?
Sure. I mean, you know, we already had, pre Prop 64, there were already stoned drivers on the road. So just legalizing and regulating does not change the fact that people are driving under the influence. What Prop 64 did was it provided an opportunity for the state to have some financial resources to study the effects of driving under the influence of marijuana, and ultimately to start to initiate different procedures and testing to try to determine whether drivers are in fact under the influence for the purpose of driving.
So legalization didn't invent cars and weed?
Absolutely not. No, I mean, hey, that was one of the big from the anti-Prop 64 people that say, hey, you know, we're going to have stone drivers all over the place. And it's like, hey, that's already happening.
It hasn't seemed to have been that big of a problem in the state of California or anywhere else that we're looking, but they're always seeking some way to try to discredit the reforms of marijuana, marijuana laws. Another concern, one that gained a lot of attention in Colorado, has to do with edibles, their marketing, their packaging, and the worry about children accidentally ingesting them. How has that been covered as far as the media's portrayal of this and people's reaction to that issue?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, and that also has been a big issue. People hear those, you know, the horror stories of a kid eating a 1,000-milligram cookie and having to go to the emergency room. There are some news reporters that had some similar issues. And, you know, California's Proposition 64 has added some protections. There are certain types of food products that cannot be sold, things that are geared towards children or that can be mistaken for candies and other food that children eat. So there are some protections included. Obviously, everyone wants to make sure that no one's, you know, eating something that they shouldn't and that can get them extremely high.
Let's move to the broader mission of Law Enforcement Action Partnership, as you guys are fighting for reforms in law enforcement beyond just the drug war. What are some of the things happening in California? I know we recently had the 25th anniversary of the L.A. riots that were started off of the Rodney King video and the acquittal of the police officers there. When it comes to police brutality and these issues that have gotten so much attention recently, how is Prop 64 fitting into that? And as a member of LEAP, how are you guys fighting to reform those police-citizen interactions?
I think Prop 64 is important. You know, the war on drugs has been disproportionately affecting people of color, minorities. And with Proposition 64, with legalized cannabis, it takes away the ability of police to harass people for simple possession or use of marijuana. And I think that that's especially important for minority communities. So, you know, we're expecting that to result in less minority arrests, incarceration, probation, further arrests. And I think all in all, thus far, it's been very positive.
And yet what we've seen statistically coming out of Colorado and Washington following their legalization is that for the marijuana crimes that do remain on the books, they're still being disproportionately enforced against people of color. Are there any mechanisms within California's Prop 64 or the law enforcement community to address post-legalization racial disparities?
You know, that's a very tricky issue, and I think all we can really do is discuss it. It's education. It's bringing attention to this issue. And I think with social media nowadays and you know, everyone has a phone that can, you know, where you can browse the web and get really any information you need at your fingertips, it's more of an educational component. And we really just want to teach law enforcement about these issues. And hopefully with that education, we can protect minority communities from some of these issues.
Now that we're moving into the post-legalization world, at least legalization of cannabis, there is some more attention toward other drugs, and particularly in this country, the attention being given to the opioid overdose epidemic, where we've seen tens of thousands of people passing away from opioid overdoses. What are some of the reforms you're fighting for there in California to help people in the use of other drugs, and has law enforcement been receptive to these reforms?
Yeah, absolutely. We passed Prop 47 a couple of years ago, and you know, ultimately Prop 47 reduced several felony possession, simple possession of most drugs, to misdemeanors. So that's been, that was a huge step for California. We've seen that unclog the courts. People aren't being put on felony probation. They're looking at less custody time. They're not, if they're on misdemeanor probation in most jurisdictions in California, they're not subject to drug testing. So, you know, we're, Prop 47 has been huge. And, you know, I think we're really just pushing for, all in all, in our organization, the decriminalization of all drugs, because we believe this is a public health issue. This isn't a something that should be dealt with in the criminal courts.
How about some of the proposed harm reduction efforts, things like needle exchange or naloxone? Are those coming along in California?
You know, it's starting to, but it really hasn't come along the way that we would like. But that is something that we are pushing for. We'd like to see safe places for people to consume their narcotics. We'd like to see safe, clean needles. Really, again, it's a public health issue, and we want to see it treated as such.
In the California Assembly, there's been some discussion of making or passing a bill that would turn California into a so-called sanctuary state with respect to federal drug laws. Colorado has also moved forward with some changes to try to protect their industry should Jeff Sessions and the Trump administration want to crack down on marijuana. Do you have any report on the progress of that politically, and what's your feeling on directing state law enforcement to not cooperate with the feds?
Well, I believe state law enforcement has a duty to comply with state law. And creating a situation where California is considered a sanctuary state, I mean, I don't even know that we necessarily need to do that. These law enforcement officers, they do have a duty to follow California law. And California law says that certain activities are legal. If you start cooperating with federal law enforcement, to arrest and prosecute individuals that are in compliance with state law, in my opinion, you are violating your duty to the state of California.
Interesting. So with respect to these multi-jurisdictional task forces, high-intensity drug trafficking stuff, where they co-opt county sheriffs and local cops to help out with these federal sort of investigations, the fact that they might be going after something that's federally illegal, in your opinion, the locals shouldn't be involved with that?
No, they shouldn't be involved with that. And what I hope to see happen is if the feds do decide to step in and start enforcing federal cannabis laws against businesses that are legal and individuals who are operating legally under state law, I would hope that these local law enforcement agencies would then stop providing assistance in other cases as well. I mean, really, it's, hey, if you want our help to go after the large scale criminal enterprises, the meth dealers, other hard drugs, then you need to stay away from the people who we're here to protect and the businesses that were that are legal under California law.
Very well put. Well, Michael Sindrich is a speaker with Law Enforcement Action Partnership, and you can find more fine speakers like him in your area by visiting leap.cc or policeforreform.com. And before we let you go, Michael, the other organizations you're working with, any promotions or websites or contact information you'd like to give out?
We're doing some great work with current and former NFL players through the Gridiron Cannabis Foundation. That's gridironcannabis.org, and I invite you to check it out.
All right. Thank you so much, Michael Sindrich, for all the work you're doing in California, and keep it up.
Thank you.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. Subscribe now for free at mjagenda.com.
New beginner guitars and banjos are often constructed much better than ones built before your time. Why struggle? Get a new instrument or fix the old one. The trusted professionals at the Fingerboard Extension will evaluate your instrument for free. Repairs are priced for people who work for a living. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension downtown Corvallis at 120 Northwest 2nd Street today, or check out its inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com.
It's time for Cannabis Facts About Alzheimer's from Robert Platschorn's thesilvertour.org. This message is supported by our donors and Hemp Inc., a public company poised to lead America's hemp revolution at hempinc.com. A new Florida study in the journal Molecular and Cellular Neuroscience found that cannabis promotes the growth of healthy new brain tissue. It can slow the effects of Alzheimer's and may, in fact, be able to halt it entirely. A long-term study by Ohio State University's Professor Gary Wenk concludes that people who regularly use marijuana get Alzheimer's at a much lower rate than others. This was Cannabis Facts from thesilvertour.org, an educational nonprofit supported by our donors and Hemp Inc., a public company poised to lead America's hemp revolution at hempinc.com.
The marijuana agenda, like the conservative agenda, minus the hypocrisy.
I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. Join me for A Sensible Future from Students for Sensible Drug Policy every other Tuesday here on the Marijuana Agenda. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
Promoting the end of adult cannabis prohibition is easy because we have facts, science, reason, compassion, evidence, truth, and logic on our side. It's even easier when researchers catalog it all for us. Learn how to gather the facts on marijuana use, arrests, seizures, rehabs, drug tests, and more on this edition of Drug War Data Mining.
Today in the Drug War Data Mines, we take a look at the Marijuana Business Factbook for 2017. This has just been released by mjbizdaily.com. You can find this at mjbizdaily.com, the Marijuana Business Daily. And the headline, exclusive, U.S. marijuana sales could rise 35% in 2017 and hit $17 billion annually by 2021. That's great news. The MJ Biz Daily report is predicting this, that we'll hit $5 to $6 billion in legal sales just this year, according to their projections. And looking at the projections for 2017, they are projecting between $2.5 to $3.2 billion in the medical marijuana markets and 2.6 to 2.9 in the recreational marijuana markets. So pretty much a break even or an even split, you should say, between medical and adult use sales. But as their projections widen out to 2021, the recreational market begins to take a greater share of their projection. They're estimating between $11.9 and $17.1 billion for the 2021 market. And of that, $4.8 to $6.8 billion in medical, $7.1 to $10.3 in adult use sales. So now we're getting to more of a 60-40, 70-30 type of split between the recreational markets and the medical markets. According to Chris Walsh, the editor of Marijuana Business Daily, quote, "The marijuana industry is primed and pumped for explosive growth in the foreseeable future, provided there isn't a significant crackdown at the federal level. The business opportunities that will emerge in the coming years are tremendous for both existing marijuana companies and new ones that start up. Sales in 2017 are expected to grow by roughly a third over the $4 to $4.5 billion the industry racked up last year. And according to these predictions, this may be the first year, 2017, where recreational marijuana sales outpace medical cannabis sales in this nation. So we will keep an eye on those figures. According to the marijuana industry, the Marijuana Business Daily projections, they say the 11 states that passed marijuana-related measures that still have yet to get their programs up and running are going to generate as much as $7 billion annually by 2021 themselves.
This, of course, is also a lot of uncertainty because you don't know how well the future administrations are going to implement the laws that have been passed by the legislatures or the people. You end up with a governor or committee heads throughout the process who are antagonistic toward medical cannabis laws or recreational laws. They can throw a lot of roadblocks in the way. Witness what's going on in the state of Florida, where the people there, by a 71% vote, passed their Amendment 2, legalizing the medical use of cannabis under a physician's recommendation in the state, and the legislature adjourned without even getting around to setting what the regulations shall be. And under the constitutionally passed amendment, the Department of Health now has the free rein to set what those regulations will be. This has already led to some conflict in Florida medical marijuana. There is a Trulieve, a dispensary down there in Florida, that has been selling the cannabis flower, which is allowed. Cannabis flower is allowed, but for vaporization only. And they're selling it in a container that is supposed to be vaporized, but is, of course, easily opened. And one can take the herb out and roll it up and smoke it, or put it in a pipe or a bong and smoke it. And the Department of Health has now issued a warning to this dispensary to stop selling the herbal cannabis because of this misuse. Under the Florida amendment, smoking is illegal under for medical cannabis. You're not allowed to smoke it, but you're allowed to vaporize flower. This will be the most ignored regulation since for tobacco use only in a head shop in the 1970s. But the Florida medical marijuana program persists, and this will definitely lead to some lawsuits over whether or not people have access to the whole plant cannabis, or whether or not the Department of Health can restrict that access just because of how some people might use the whole plant cannabis in an unapproved way. The California market, in this projection from MJBizDaily.com, could generate $4.5 to $5 billion in annual retail sales for their California projections. And they're saying that 2021, California will account for 76% of the total revenue for new recreational markets. Undoubtedly, the state is the sixth biggest economy in the world. It's certainly going to dominate the recreational marijuana market. Other highlights from their released fact book today: roughly 50% of the revenue-generating cannabis companies are either actively trying to raise capital or plan to this year. And with average profit margins of 19%, dispensaries and rec stores are doing quite well in terms of profitability. Wait, this just in: selling marijuana is a good business. Also in the report, a majority of infused product companies are manufacturing more than one type of good, typically edibles and concentrates, but only 6% are manufacturing topicals exclusively. And on the employment front, the cannabis industry employs 165,000 to 230,000 full and part-time workers. You want to make America great again? You want to bring jobs back? You want to bring a growth industry back to this country? It's time to legalize cannabis for all adults, for whatever purpose they deem fit, with nobody's permission needed. This is the engine that can revitalize the American economy, that can put our farmers back to work growing and harvesting industrial hemp. Hemp for victory for this country once again. Check out the MJ Biz Daily Report, the most trusted cannabis news source since 2011. It's at MJBizDaily.com. Exclusive: U.S. marijuana sales could rise 35% in 2017 and hit $17 billion by 2021. We're going to take a break, and don't forget, if you're up there in the great, great white north of Alaska, I'll be in Anchorage this weekend. I'm hosting the Cannabis Classic Awards. Check it out at GoCannabisClassic.com. And tomorrow, we will have a pre-recorded show since I'll be flying to Alaska.
You're listening to The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Hey everybody, it's Russ Belville from The Marijuana Agenda, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop.
Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
This is Cannabis Facts from Robert Platshorn's thesilvertour.org. Supported by our donors and Hemp Inc., poised to lead America's hemp revolution at hempinc.com. In 1937, the second most prescribed medicine, marijuana, was banned. It wasn't about marijuana. The paper, oil, and chemical industries lobbied to end hemp farming. No longer labor-intensive, an acre of hemp produced more quality paper than 4 acres of trees. Plastics and fibers could be produced from a plant. Hemp can even produce 10 times the energy of today's ethanol. As marijuana prohibition ends, many states now allow farmers to again grow hemp. This was Cannabis Facts from thesilvertour.org, an educational nonprofit supported by our donors and Hemp Inc., a public company poised to process America's hemp crop at hempinc.com.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
I'm Russ Belville from The Marijuana Agenda. Join me every 4 weeks for the Celebrity Marijuana Zone with Steve Bloom from celebstoner.com. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
For decades, what about the children? Was a rallying cry for concerned parents fighting to keep marijuana away from their kids. Now, advances in medical cannabis technology have parents fighting to access marijuana to save their kids. In some cases, those parents who utilize medical cannabis have to then fight the state for their kids. Today, we're joined by another guest from Moms for Marijuana International as we ask, what about the children?
Welcome to What About the Children, our podcast dedicated to the issues of marijuana use and parenting. I'm Russ Belville. Joining me today to discuss the issue is the founder of Moms for Marijuana, Sarah Frank, a longtime activist here in the Pacific Northwest and, of course, a medical cannabis patient as well. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Always a pleasure, Russ. Thank you.
So the organization Moms for Marijuana, give folks the basics about why you founded this organization and what issues you're fighting for.
Well, it began as an outlet through social media, originally on MySpace, where I just shared information I was learning about marijuana. I had found it for myself medically, and I felt it was important to share it with other people, especially in Idaho, where I'm from, and you know, just kind of get it out there to the world what was going on about marijuana. And that kind of developed into a network of parents around the world who are just, you know, focused on doing the same thing, just getting the information out there, promoting education, raising awareness, creating discussion about everything to do with cannabis, not just marijuana.
Of course, the issue of marijuana use in many states is now medically accepted, and in 8 states is legal for all adults 21 and older. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the authorities are so excited about the use of marijuana by parents. And can you give our listeners some of the basics about what's been going on for parents who've been caught by law enforcement using their cannabis, even in states where it's accepted?
There's so much. It's devastating to see what happens to parents on many different levels. You have the, you know, getting caught with it, having to deal with the court system, the potential of having to face jail time, and then what do you do with your family, your job, things like that that affect your family if you're having to go spend time in jail or pay restitution or anything just for getting caught with your medicine. There's also the child protective services aspects of it where, and sometimes they go hand in hand, you know, a parent will be busted criminally and then, you know, persecuted criminally. And then child protective services will come and get involved in their lives and get them into services, which then is more time away from the family, more time away, money that is spent away from the family, and all these different things affect the children. And then there are the ones who are taken from their home. And that's where it just gets heartbreaking, is to hear these stories and learn about these families that are just ripped apart because a parent is using medical marijuana, or because a parent is using recreational marijuana, or because a child is being given, you know, it as a drug, because they've, all the parents around the country and around the world are waking up to the medical aspects, and they're choosing to medicate their children despite the law. And so having a child taken away and then having to go and fight the stigma in the court, it's just devastating.
What are the justifications being given by Child Protective Service authorities when it comes to taking kids from marijuana using parents? I mean, is it just simply in some places that it's illegal, or are they actually claiming there's some imminent danger to the child?
Oh, they charge them with injury to a child in a lot of cases when it has to do with a, you know, smoking around a child or giving the child the marijuana, as the case we had here in Gooding, Idaho recently. The mother had given the child marijuana, so they charged her with injury to a child. And the marijuana was given to the child to stop hallucinations and the seizures because her family had experiences with it, helping with things like that in Colorado. So parents hear these stories, they learn, you know, the medical aspects, they see it happen through memes and things on Facebook and social media, and they believe it will help their child, and they choose in their desperate moment to give their child the medicine like she did. But then they come in and they charge them with injury to a child or child endangerment. So they're doing this solely on the belief that cannabis is dangerous. And that's the stigma that a lot of parents have to fight in court, you know, and unless you get a judge who has done their research, they have the same kind of programmed stigma in their head about marijuana and that it's dangerous, more dangerous than heroin. So they treat it as such, and they look at these parents like they're heroin addicts.
What a shame. And how much of this, you know, we want to give people the benefit of the doubt of having the best interest of the child at heart. But when you look deeper into the Child Protective Service and foster care system, do you find other perverse incentives, financial incentives, other things that might be affecting the decision to go after these parents?
Well, there was a senator in Georgia, Nancy Schaefer, and I think she puts it best that she believes that the Child Protective System as a whole across the country has become corrupted and is broken almost beyond repair. And there is an entire movement, just much like the cannabis movement out there, which is the Exposed Child Protective Services and the anti-CPS movement and Fight CPS movement. And as you start delving into that, you start to see that marijuana is just one of many, many, many things that they use to get into the system. So it's, you know, you're fighting a stigma through the courts, you're fighting the stigma through family courts, and then you're involved in a system that in itself is broken. So these parents get drug along, and none of this is in the best interest of the child. If it was in the best interest of the child, they would be working to keep the families together. But as you know, there's a lot of perverse reasons why Child Protective Services gets involved with families. And, you know, it's not every social worker, it's not every area, but the system itself is damaged, and I believe totally beyond repair. Not almost beyond repair, but it's we need to completely not revamp and just abolish Child Protective Services and create a community organization and a community protection organization where families help each other rather than punish them for, you know, a mistake they made as a parent.
What are some of the,
if we,
oh, I'm sorry. Sorry to interrupt. I was going to say, what are some of the outcomes in cases you've dealt with as far as how CPS may have done more damage to the child than marijuana ever could have?
And that's when it starts breaking my heart, Russ. I start thinking of cases like Alex Hill. She was a little 2-year-old in Texas, and Texas is one of the worst places for Child Protective Services corruption. And the father had admitted to smoking a joint in his living room while he was watching a movie. His wife, I believe, suffered from seizures. And I believe that they were, you know, medical users. I would have to verify that, so I don't want to say exactly that. But so Alex was asleep in the other room while her parents smoked a joint. And they admitted to this to a Child Protective Services social worker who showed up at the door because a relative, in spite, you know, in a conflict, had called them and said, hey, they use marijuana, go talk to them. And so that's what they do. They get these referrals. And they have 30 days, 30 to 90 days, depending on the state, to go and check out these referrals. And they determine whether or not they are founded, they're unfounded, or depending on where you're at, you know, the terminology is different. But they determine whether or not they have a basis for creating a case plan with that family to help them under the guise of protecting their children. And in reality, what it is they want them to do assessments. And in any assessment that they do, they're going to end up being put into a service because the state receives federal funding for these services. So in order to get more funding next year, the state has to have more people in their services this year. So they get them put up in these services, and marijuana use is definitely a key factor. It's like an automatic, you get drug rehabilitation classes. You get, you know, you have to have, like, in my personal case, very personal case with Billy, it was they wanted him to do drug rehab. So I'm not sure the specific with Alex's parents, but they wanted them to do all these services. And a lot of those will include counseling and domestic violence assessments. And they'll put them in these services and keep this case plan going for weeks, months, years at a time, depending on the case. And the way the social workers get the parents to do these things is to threaten them with court involvement. They'll say, okay, well, if you don't do these things and sign this case plan, we're going to take you to court and make you sign it. So unless you do it willingly, we're going to force you to do it. So there's no choice here. You're going to end up doing these classes. And once you get in these classes, then, you know, in a lot of cases, like in Alex's case, they took the child from the home. So you only get weekly visits with your children, and you only get, you know, you have to go do these classes and then go to court. And it's almost like being on probation is what it reminds me of. So Alex's parents were in these classes, and they were almost completely done. And they had been to court, and the court told them that in a couple of weeks, you'll be done and your daughter can come home. And within that time period, the foster mother abused her to the point where she passed away. And it's, you know, over marijuana. It's people are dying in foster care. And if your children are six times more likely to be abused or die in foster care than they are in the general public. And all over marijuana, it, in a lot of cases, it's almost an automatic guarantee that the court will say, yes, you have to do these things because you tested positive for marijuana, even in legal states. And what we do, I'm with, you know, Moms for Marijuana International, but I'm also with the Fight for Lily Foundation. And as you know, we go around and we teach parents how to do this. We teach parents how to fight back. We teach parents how to say, hey, we need evidence here. We need evidence like any other court. And we need to fight back at, like any other court, with cross-examining these witnesses to find out what exactly is the reason that these children are removed from their home. And if it's marijuana, you need to provide evidence of how it's harmful, because as we all know, it's not.
Yeah. We could use a lot more truth in our procedures here when it comes to Child Protective Services. And it's not to say that we don't want children to be protected from abuse and neglect and dangerous situations. It's just that marijuana use is none of those things. Studies show that kids do better even with troubled homes than they do being put in foster care. So there's no real good reason to be doing this. We need to wrap up here, Sarah. So let's tell the listeners a little more about how they can get information about your group and how to move forward on this issue of Child Protective Services.
The best place is definitely social media. You know, Moms for Marijuana International will share a lot through Facebook. And then, you know, the Fight for Lily, fightforlily.org. It's Lily with two L's, L-I-L-L-Y. But any parent who wants to educate themselves about what's going on with CPS and how to fight back and how to stand up for their family and protect their family, especially as a marijuana user, you just have to use Google. You just have to become that law student overnight and learn what your rights are, because in this country, our rights as parents are protected more so than the rights of Child Protective Services to come in and protect your child under the guise, you know, over marijuana and trying to protect them from a drug that is not dangerous.
Sarah Franks, thanks so much for all you're doing for the parents out there trying to help keep their kids safe. We appreciate it. I encourage everyone to check out Moms for Marijuana on the internet, on Facebook, and get connected and get involved. Thanks, Sarah, and good luck with all your future endeavors.
Thank you, Russ.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. Subscribe now for free at mjagenda.com.
The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville is proudly sponsored by the Marijuana Business Association. The MJBA, called by NBC News the Cannabis Chamber of Commerce, is the fastest growing business association and the fastest growing industry in America. I've been working with the MJBA for years, and I personally invite you to join the MJBA. MJBA also publishes the popular MJ Headline News on Facebook and the MJNewsNetwork.com and Marijuana Channel 1 on YouTube. Visit MJBA.net for more details.
It's time for Cannabis Facts About Teen Drug Use from Robert Platschorn's thesilvertour.org. This message is supported by our donors and Hemp Inc., a public company poised to lead America's hemp revolution at hempinc.com. A recent survey by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control indicates that in states that have legalized medical marijuana, the rate of marijuana consumption among high school students has not increased. In fact, in legal states like Colorado, teen use has actually decreased significantly. It's simply no longer a big deal for teenagers in legal states. This was Cannabis Facts from thesilvertour.org, an educational nonprofit supported by our donors and Hemp Inc., a public company poised to lead America's hemp revolution at hempinc.com.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
I'm Russ Belville with the Marijuana Agenda. Join me every 2 weeks for the Cannabis Minority Report from the Minority Cannabis Business Association. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
Total war against public enemy number one.
10 federal criminal penalties for up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
Marijuana is probably the most dangerous drug.
Legalization is just another word for surrender.
I experimented with marijuana and didn't inhale.
This is not medicine. This is a Cheech and Chong show.
Encourage people to use less drugs.
I am ill. That was the point.
I think it would be a mistake to legalize.
Negative reports coming out of Colorado.
People don't smoke marijuana.
Following rant is a piece by Jeffrey Robinson from the ACLU. I'm not going to shoot you, brother. In what world do those words being said by a police officer result in that officer being fired? You don't have to go down the rabbit hole in search of a place where up is down, left is right, war is peace. All you need to do is go to Weirton, West Virginia. Police officer Stephen Mader was fired from his job for not killing a black man when he could have. He's now in a battle that seems both absurd and highlights the absurdity of our times. He has to sue to regain his reputation and his right to work because he did not kill a suicidal man who was armed with an unloaded gun. That's right, an unloaded gun. R.J. Williams was grappling with depression when his former girlfriend called 911
and reported that Mr. Williams had an unloaded gun and was suicidal. Officer Mader, however, arrived on the scene before that information was even relayed to law enforcement, so he was going to have to rely on his training in the absence of this information. How his use of that training steered his actions tells vital things about police training and police action. When Mader pulled up, Mr. Williams brought his hands from behind his back, revealing a gun. Mader was facing a black man with a gun, without backup, at night, on the street. We've seen this story before. We've seen how it usually plays out. The police kill another black man, excuses are made for the officer who shot, and the media cycles through its outrage or lack thereof. Then the nation returns to business as usual. It's the callous cycle of black killing. So why didn't Mader shoot to kill? This is a deceptively simple question with important, complex answers that reveal the problems with our criminal justice system. Given the reality of policing in America, his refusal to shoot an armed black man could not have come from fear of prosecution. In 2015, The Guardian reported that police in America killed 1,145 people. There were 18 prosecutions. Black men were killed at twice the rate of whites, and black men between 15 to 34 years of age were killed at five times the rates of whites in the same age group. Unarmed black men are killed by police every year, and the consequences are frighteningly similar. Leave with pay until the no charges to be filed decision is announced, and then head back to work, sometimes with a promotion. Prosecution is the last thing Mader had to worry about. So, if it wasn't fear of prosecution, what was it? The answer? He followed his training and had a deep respect for the sanctity of life. Mader did not shoot because he did what conscientious law enforcement leaders say every officer should do. He analyzed the full situation. By taking into account all the factors he could, he consequently saw more than a black man with a gun. He saw a person in distress who was not acting aggressively. R.J. Williams never aimed his gun at Officer Mader. Having been trained in the military in de-escalation tactics, Mader followed his training. Instead of yelling, "Get on the ground or I'll blow your head off," he calmed his voice and spoke slowly and softly. He engaged. He listened to what Williams was saying, which amounted to repeated pleas to just shoot me. He evaluated Williams' demeanor. Even though the dispatcher failed to say that the gun was not loaded, Mader came to that conclusion. Mader understood he was facing someone who was trying to commit suicide by cop. He saw someone who was in intense pain, not someone looking to hurt him. Officer Mader showed the bravery and compassion we should value in every police officer. "I'm not going to shoot you, brother," he told R.J. Williams. Then, two other officers arrived on the scene, and the situation worsened. Mr. Williams began to raise his hand with the gun, and one of the newly arrived officers shot and killed him. Officer Mader's assessment that the gun was unloaded were confirmed when the gun was checked. By this time, Mr. Williams had indeed committed suicide by cop. The situation should have been de-escalated. De-escalation saves lives, full stop. His training served Officer Mader well, and it led him to make the right decision. His department did not serve him well. It fired him for making the right decision. That's what's wrong with the criminal justice system today, as seen on a community level with law enforcement. In Chicago, Laquan McDonald had a knife in his hand and was shot 16 times in 14 seconds. The situation was not de-escalated. In Camden, New Jersey, a man with a knife in his hand was approached by police, and instead of killing him, they followed him for several minutes, clearing people out of harm's way, until they could tackle him and take him into custody with no one injured, no one killed. That situation was de-escalated by police. Respect for life and adherence to de-escalation techniques is what we should expect from our police officers. It's why training is critically necessary. It saves lives. We should not fire cops who act heroically. We should not fire cops who use their training to protect community members, especially when they are in distress.
Officer Mader did everything in his power to preserve life that night in Weirton, West Virginia. He resisted the impulse to respond with force. He was on his way to saving Mr. Williams' life when the other two officers arrived. If we mean what we say about the need for de-escalation in police departments around America, Stephen Mader deserves our thanks, he deserves our praise, but most importantly, he deserves our job back. Thanks for joining us, and until next time, take care of each other, Tokers.
Follow MJ Agenda on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, and SoundCloud. And follow MJ Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
You say you're free, you're planet, you're growing, you're giant, you're rolling, you're smoking. You take a seat, you're planet, you're growing, you're giant, you're rolling, you're smoking. You take a seat, you're